If you were a part of Milwaukee's punk rock scene, we've got a book for you. You'll hear all about that book from book editor Jim Higgins coming up in today's Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for tuning in. President Donald Trump started debate last week when he issued an executive order suspending the U.S. refugee program for 120 days. The ban bars refugees from 7 majority Muslim countries indefinitely. It also bans citizens from those countries from traveling to the United States for 90 days. Americans of many faiths have been leading efforts to resettle and serve immigrants from around the world. For many, care of the stranger is a central part of their faith. Now, religious communities from across Wisconsin and the country are grappling with how to uphold their beliefs without alienating faithful members who support the president. Reporter Anissa Johnson joins me with the story. So I'm here with reporter Anissa Johnson. You have a story coming out this weekend. Can you walk me through it?
This story looks at how faith communities, particularly clergy and hierarchy, are dealing with the recent presidential ban that bars refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries, and how they are grappling with trying to sort of speak to the central tenets of their faith without also alienating people who may be on different ends of the political spectrum.
How did you get the idea for this story?
Well, like we get most of our stories, just talking to people in our community. Society or churches, like society as a whole, are often divided on political issues. And because care of the stranger, compassion, mercy are so central to most faith traditions, it was obvious that this was going to be a hot-button issue for churches, synagogues, mosques.
And how did people of faith vote in the last election?
Well, actually, President Trump took the majority of voters, Catholic voters, evangelical voters, Mormons, and a particularly white Catholic and white evangelical voters.
What are some of the messages that congregants in different churches are receiving from their clergy members or from their leaders? And how does that tend to break down in terms of the way that different faith communities voted?
Well, you know, it's all over the board. So, for example, in a Catholic church, you might get a message from a very orthodox or conservative pastor who, in fact, I quote a priest in my story who says that people who criticize the ban are misrepresenting the gospel. And you may also get a message, the message from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is that the ban is wrongheaded and not in keeping with Catholic tradition. So you can see that people are all over the board.
So who did you talk to for this story, and what did they say?
Well, what I always try to do is cast a wide net. So I talked to Catholics, evangelicals, Muslim, Jewish, Protestant, clergy, leaders, active people in those communities. And really, like the Catholic example I gave you, they're kind of all over. I would say the majority of the people I talked to really wanted to stress that banning refugees, especially vulnerable people who are facing persecution, often death, torture, that's just not in keeping with their faith traditions. That's the majority of what I heard.
And did you get the sense that religious leaders were bracing themselves for potentially more conflicts moving forward?
Absolutely. You probably know the president's theme at a prayer breakfast this week was religious freedom. And, of course, everyone supports the idea of religious freedom, but there's so much debate about what that really constitutes and what that should look like. Is it the right to refuse service to gay and lesbian people? Is it... Is it the right for individuals to get access to birth control because of their health care? Is it the right to endorse political candidates? All of that is likely to be on the table, and those will all be very divisive issues that it may, in fact, involve the courts to resolve.
Anissa's story ran in Saturday's paper. If you're looking to read it now, you can find it on jsonline.com. The Violent Femmes aren't the only rock band of note to come out of Milwaukee in the 60s and 70s. A new book takes a look at the city's entire punk rock scene in those decades in an oral history that brought back some memories for book editor Jim Higgins. He sat down with Chelsea Lewis to talk about the book and the city's music scene 50 years ago.
So, Jim, you have a book review in this Sunday's top section on a pretty cool book about some Milwaukee history. You mentioned in your review that this actually triggered some memories for you. Why is that?
Well, Chelsea, this book's called Brick Through the Window, An Oral History of Punk Rock, New Wave, and Noise in Milwaukee in 1964 to 84. And the latter part of that time period, I was first a Marquette student and then a young guy in Milwaukee, and I saw some of these bands. I fondly remember seeing the Oil Tasters at the Starship. That would have been 1981 or 1982. And so a lot of this is the music of my youth, and I'm sure for many of our readers and listeners, of their youth in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. And it touches on, of course, perhaps Milwaukee's most famous band, Violent Femmes. But you mentioned that there's a whole, I mean, it's a pretty good encyclopedia of not just punk music, but all kinds.
Right. It's really about local rock music, local, what we'd call now independent or alternative, or people who made their own music, as mm-hmm. opposed to cover bands and show type bands. And it begins in the mid 60s, although the bulk of it is really about the 70s and 80s. And one important thing to remember about that time period is the drinking age was 18. Mm-hmm. So you could be 18 and go out to live music in clubs and bars in Milwaukee. And that makes a huge difference, because now with the scene's 21, you need intermediate places for those 18 to 21-year-olds. Then you didn't. You could be 18 and be in a band and be out. And so there was a big crowd of young people who wanted to go out and see and hear music. For these bands, of course, the challenge was the popular stuff that sold drinks was usually cover bands or more commercially oriented rock. And these were all people making it up themselves, sometimes very amateurish, sometimes good. And they always had to battle to find places to play.
So. Yeah, and you also remarked that, you know, this was pre-iTunes, pre-Bandcamp. So the discovery process for new bands was a little harder.
The key word here is posters. Now, I won't presume about your age, Chelsea, but you probably don't remember the key vehicle for both promoting your band and finding out about your bands was posters. Mm-hmm. You know, bands had to make posters and put them on all the telephone poles and other places you could around town, and it became this sort of, to use an anachronistic word, sort of grungy art form of making your posters and getting the word out. Right, so bands had to work hard through word of mouth, posters, listings to get the word out, and the same with finding out about bands. So.
Yeah. I do remember that from my college days. That seemed to be still big when I was in college.
I'm sure that was a retro thing for you.
Yeah. So, and one thing I remarked to you is that this is a fat book. It's like 700 pages. So, but you said it was actually pretty enjoyable because of those memories and stuff that it brought up.
It's an oral history, so really the authors, in roughly chronological chapters, are it's like a big transcript of mm-hmm. interviews with people, and they try to organize around bands or events or people, and so you really can skip the parts that don't interest you to, or really dive into the parts that do. And one of my tests on a work of nonfiction is there an index? And there is here, so it's very easy to look up your favorite bands. This book's kind of a version 2.0 of a book that came out under a different title 3 years ago that was fun but sort of slapdash. And they've done a great job here with organization, with just making it a pleasure to read and to browse through.
To read Jim's complete review of the book, visit tapmilwaukee.com. When Bob Breitenbach became ill, his employer went to extraordinary ends to make sure Bob and his family were cared for. Business editor Jim Nelson and reporter Rick Rimmel join us with that story.
Hi, this is Jim Nelson with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I'm here with Rick Rimmel, business reporter, who has a very interesting tale about an employer doing things right.
Hey, Jim. Yeah, that's right. It's the employer is Standard Electric Supply Company. They're an almost 100-year-old firm located in the Menominee Valley. You'd probably never find them if you you'd really have to look for them to find them. But they have an engineer by the name of Bob Breitenbach. I should say they had. He no longer works for the company, who became really seriously ill and had trouble continuing to work, but was able to keep working for the company for quite a while because of the accommodations they extended to him.
What is what's his illness? What's his ailment?
Bob has a really serious lung disease. It's a form of COPD, and it has left him basically bedridden now. He's lost a large amount of weight. He has trouble just getting up and moving it because he's so weakened by this condition, which makes it harder and harder for him to breathe. And it's a progressive disease that, and there is not a cure for it.
Wow. And the company, it's from looking at your story, sounds like the company's kind of in a quiet way rallied around him.
That's exactly right. And the owner, Larry Stern, he's the third-generation family owner of Standard Electric. It was founded by, among others, his grandfather in 1919. He says that's the way we do it. We're not looking for recognition. And indeed, the company did not reach out to us on this. Bob Breitenbach contacted an editor and said he wanted to talk about his situation because he was so grateful to his employer and the people that he worked with. So they to start with, Bob is he's basically a self-taught engineer, and Standard Electric is a distributor of high-tech automation and electronic control equipment that is used to run factories and machines in factories. It's very complicated stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Breitenbach is a business graduate of UWM. He's not an engineering student, but he worked at some electronics firms and picked up enough knowledge that when he joined Standard in 2006, he tested really well on the engineering aspect of the job. He was going applying to be a salesman there. So they made him an engineer, which means he sort of supports the sales staff in the field when they're out, you know, at a company like Kohler or Harley-Davidson or whatever, and they're selling this this complicated equipment. And he also supports, Bob would be a person who also supports the staff at the customer company that's trying to make sure the equipment works properly.
So, you know, what struck me is Bob has only been there a relatively short period of time. It's not like this is a legacy employee who has been there 45 years or something.
No, about 10 years is his work span there. And what happened was he's had this, the roots of this disease go back decades. But he had kind of lived with it, and he was, you know, he was a guy who ran or jogged, as he said. He played racquetball regularly. But as time went on, he became sort of weaker and weaker, and he found it more difficult to fulfill his job responsibilities. So what the company did was they gave him a couple of leaves of absence. They allowed him change his work location from the office in downtown Milwaukee to their Madison office. Bob lives in Exonia. Uh-huh. So Madison's a little farther in miles, but it was an easier drive for him. And this drive downtown in heavy traffic was exhausting him. Then when he became more and more ill, he was on oxygen, started to go on oxygen all the time, and found it difficult even to work for Madison. They said, well, go ahead and work at home. And they don't do that normally. Mm-hmm. But they did it for him. They also exempted him from having to be at sales meetings or company retreats, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he did that. And they also told him, you know, work as many hours as you can. Don't worry about it. And he did. But one day last summer, he was in his desk at home, and he got so weak, he said, I just laid my head down on my desk and said, I can't work anymore. And that was it. Now, after that, the company started a fund to help with his medical expenses. And I guess the larger thing is people started extending all these small and large kindnesses, coming to his house to repair a motion detector that had gone bad in the driveway. A cold, snowy night, an engineer from the company comes out and fixes it. A lot of people would call, would visit, text back and forth with him. One coworker came down to Bob's house fairly recently, and with her husband, they tore out this shag carpeting from his bedroom so that he could get a new, better hospital bed installed. People would send him books that he liked. He used to go to Door County around Christmas time every year with his family. He has a wife and a 14-year-old son. Mm-hmm. They live in the house in Exonia. And every year, he would see one of the executives of the company, typically at Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant, yeah. The place with the goats on the roof, yeah. We all know. Well, of course, he couldn't make it this past Christmas, so this guy sent Bob a box of L. Johnson's Swedish pancake mix and a bottle of syrup. And, you know, it's just those little things that have really made a difference for him.
Well, it's the little things, but it's also the big things, because the little things all added together are really, it sounds like, making a difference as this guy goes through his struggles.
He feels that very strongly.
Yeah. Sounds like a terrific story, Rick. Thanks for sharing it with us.
You bet, Jim. Good talking to you.
To read Rick's story, keep an eye on jsonline.com/business. We'll end today's show with that. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, coming to you from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If you like Behind the Headlines, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher Radio and leave a note for us in the comments as well. Catch you next week.